Okay. Order, order. Right, well, first, welcome to this, the last of the LSE London and other seminars, Monday afternoon seminars. And we're lucky to have speaking this afternoon Venki Shantaram, who's a partner at McKinsey, who's going to talk about some work undertaken by the McKinsey Global Institute. And I can say this, Venki's had to go to hospital on the way here, as may be seen as sort of obvious. So we must afford him all due hope for his recovery. And thank you very much, actually, for stepping in this afternoon to come and speak to us about this. I should add that this is the last of a terms-length series of seminars on London, looked at in various ways, everything from high speed to the future of local government funding, really. So this will be a good way to finish the term. So thank you. Over to you.
Good, thank you.
Say a few more words about yourself and whatever.
Well, let me again start with a bit of an apology. I'm almost always on time, and I feel absolutely terrible to be, almost half an hour late. And it had a little bit to, I don't want to make excuses, but it had a bit to do with our healthcare system and a bit to do with the traffic, all of which we'll talk about, I'm sure, as part of the presentation. But I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for your patience, and hopefully it'll be worthwhile. And I'm also discovering as you get older, your bones are not quite what they used to be. I'm actually also, the last thing I wanted to say before I sort of start speaking is I'm a very poor substitute for who was originally going to speak here, my colleague Charles Roxburgh, who is one of the leaders of the McKinsey Global Institute, just to spend a minute on it, in contrast to the usual private sector type of work that McKinsey does, the McKinsey Global Institute focuses more on macroeconomic sector-level issues, country-level issues, and so on and so forth. And we come up with all sorts of points of view, including the Eurozone crisis at the moment, and so on and so forth. So if that wasn't already confusing, McKinsey went ahead and also created something called a service line to serve cities, because we began to recognize that cities as an entity deserve their own sort of special client service model, given the unique challenges and unique ownership structures and so on and so forth. And they requested that I lead our service line for cities for Europe, Middle East, and Africa. So I actually spend my time, between Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, advising various cities, very well developed and, leading cities such as London, but also, greenfield cities coming up in the Middle East and explosively growing cities that we see in Africa, talking about some issues. But, having lived in the UK for the last 8 years, and this is home, and having lived in London for 5 of those 8 years, I now live out in the sticks somewhere. I have a particular passion for and interest in London. So I would very much like for this to be a conversation rather than a presentation from me to you. So please feel free to chip in with your thoughts, and that'll also give me an opportunity to sit down in a couple of minutes and we'll sort of have a bit of a conversation. So, in the McKinsey Global Institute, as I, you might have seen some of our reports, they are mostly public. But we sort of work on a range of areas, and I think the area that that I want to draw a bit of the data and information on to sort of present a perspective on London relates to our work on urbanization. And in particular, there is a Urban World report that has come out, which I think should be easily accessible from our website. If not, let me know, and through Tony, we can certainly get copies across to you. But I think we've passed a very momentous time in human history where more than half the population in the world is going to be living in cities. So looking at how cities work and sort of how to sort of really serve society is an extremely important topic for us. And in particular, we've developed something called a city scope tool in the McKinsey Global Institute. And there's one piece of research that's come out, which I'll allude to briefly. We won't focus on it very much because the focus today is very much about London. But there's a piece of work called, looking at the middle weights. Not the large established cities that we have today, not the rural parts of the world, but actually mid-size emerging cities that, and we were absolutely stunned when we saw the analysis and looked at the numbers. These middleweight cities are going to drive 70% of global economic growth between now and 2020. And these are not Beijing or Shanghai, and certainly not London or New York, even though they will all have important places in the world. But these are sort of, when you go into the interiors of China, and when you look at Chongqing or Shenzhen, or when you go into the interiors of India, when you look at Nagpur or Baroda and so on, and cities like that. And as you can imagine, these are disproportionately focused on the emerging market. And China at least has 30% of the total share of middleweights. We were absolutely stunned to see what kind of opportunity that creates. And no matter what business one is in, you know, whether you are in the infrastructure business, or whether you are in the banking and financial services business, or whether you are in the consumer business, our report suggests that it is, you really ignore the growth of the middleweights at your own peril. At the same time, I was speaking the other day at Chatham House on a similar topic. In fact, that presentation was a bit more focused on middleweights. And we had somebody from the Greater London Authority, Sir Peter Rogers, also with me on the same panel. And we got into a very interesting discussion about what it means, what the emergence of the middleweights means for a city like London. And if you're in London, what do you do about these middleweights? And I think there is huge opportunity, which we'll come to in a minute, in terms of transferring expertise, capabilities, etc., particularly in services, to some of these emerging middleweights. And we can sort of get into the debate as we move along. And as I said again, please feel free to interrupt at any time and share your thoughts and ask a question and so on. So, looking at the UK for a second, I mean, I think we are all fairly familiar with the importance of, cities in general, and to the importance of London to the UK economy overall. But I think it's worth stepping back and saying, when we look at cities, almost 80%, four-fifths of the GDP has been coming from urban areas in the last 10 years. A very strong proportion of the population has been living in urban areas. It accounts for, compared to some of the bigger numbers you see, a relatively modest share of public sector expenditure. And central government targets are 81% of that are on local spending. So there is no ignoring the importance of cities to the UK economy. And these are all, fairly well-published figures and so on and so forth, which we are quoting from. So there are really four messages that I wanted this presentation to focus on. First is to sort of reinforce why London is so important. Again, relative to what we see in the rest of the world. And I think the second and more important thing is, does it really have the potential to remain important and remain powerful over the next 10 to 20 years? And then we all know that there are challenges. We think that there are six fairly important challenges to London that I think are worth addressing. And I think it's fairly interesting having this conversation with the mayoral elections coming up in the next few weeks as well. And of course, how we think about strategy, how we would, if we were in the driving seat, how would we think about strategy for London along what dimensions? And I think it's worth probably spending a bit of time on that as well. So I apologize for the sort of small font here, but I think, again, when we sort of take our CityScope database, and it sort of says that, some of the developed country cities or developed cities are all in slightly bolder text, and some of the more emerging market cities are in more italics. But that's a bit of a nuance. But I think it's worth seeing that when you look in terms of GDP and total GDP, London is among the top five. And in fact, if you just looked at it in terms of countries, it would basically show up in the top 10 or top 15. So indisputably, we are talking about an economic powerhouse here along many dimensions, and we'll come a little bit to what it needs to do to sort of sustain and maintain that position. But to sort of put things in perspective, it is obviously in an incredibly strong position. And this position, I would say, has even improved. I mean, this is 2007, but I think when we did the numbers, the next version of the report is now out. I think it continues to remain actually very much in the top five globally. And as far as Europe is concerned, I think there is no real comparison. Because again, when you look at a number of metrics, I'm not sure why we decided to add the share of retirees column here. But I think in terms of GDP, in terms of households with annual income over 70,000, and so on, I think it's quite an impressive performance when you look at it along Europe. And a fairly interesting, I couldn't help but look at the strong Italian influence on the share of retirees column. I think, let me just walk you through what this chart says, what it says is, look, the darkest blue is around what the share of the top city is as a percentage of GDP, and all these bars add up to 100. And then the middle weights that I was discussing, and we have middle weights here in Europe as well, and they are not all restricted to China and India. And then, of course, the small cities and rural areas. What you basically see is, whether it is in terms of share of GDP or in terms of share of population, compared to the other two big economies in Europe, London, we are in the UK unusually or significantly dependent on London compared to, say, the French on Paris or Germany in the Rhein-Ruhr area, which basically encompasses Cologne, Dusseldorf, and that entire Rhine development area. And again, this is also very interesting when you sort of look at the per capita GDP gap to country, and if you said the country's GDP per capita index is at 100, then the UK and France and Germany, of course, but certainly the top cities are punching well above their weights compared to some of the middle-weight cities and as well as the smaller cities. That should not be a surprise, but I think it's interesting to see, compared again to Germany, that London's doing very well. So I think this is just some facts to show that, in terms of London's position in the UK, the level of contribution as well as the level of dependence of the country on the city remains reasonably high. Now, of course,
that's... London by a administrative boundary, or is it beyond that, to the functional core city? They look very high for London. I'm just wondering if you're counting it beyond the administrative boundary.
It is a little bit beyond the administrative boundary. I can go back and check, but I think you're right. It's not London proper. Yeah. That is definitely the outer boundary.
It looks like a sort of 12 or 13 million.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's what makes it comparable. We'll see Germany and the Rhine-Ruhr area, which also is fairly broad,
right,
as you can imagine, in terms of boundaries. This again shows the comparison a little bit more between sort of the top cities, London, Paris, and the whole Rhine-Ruhr area in sort of Germany. And I think, again, what's very interesting is when you sort of look at the 7 years of growth from 2000 to 2007 by city type, the growth rates are sort of, the compounded annual growth rate is here, and the growth rate is clearly higher for London compared to sort of Paris and the Paris and the German equivalents. And I think London's share as the overall GDP growth for the country has been actually on the increase compared to some of the other peers that you see in other markets. And you could look at this and say, hey, the development in those countries is probably a little bit more evenly spread out because of Germany's manufacturing base and so on, stretching well beyond a particular region or a particular geography. But that is sort of, you know, that's the other side of the coin, if you will, that we should probably talk about. So that's just looking back. I mean, when we sort of look forward, how do we sort of see potential for growth going forward? Again, these are now rankings as per 2025. So that was look back. This is now looking forward and sort of looking at 2025. And not surprisingly, what I said, if you recall, I mentioned that, you know, London will still remain in the top five looking into the future. But then again, as you see in terms of GDP growth, not surprisingly, you know, the first six cities are actually all Chinese cities. And some of them are familiar names like Beijing and Shanghai, but the next four are actually, you know, not so familiar names, or maybe familiar to some of you, but these are very much emerging middleweight type of cities. And where over there, I think it's fairly interesting to see even some European cities, including Moscow and so on, sort of beginning to outpace London a little bit. So I think that's still interesting. I mean, both in terms of now we are looking at households with annual income over $20,000. I think, again, London retains a fairly preeminent pace. But I think when we think about growth compared to, obviously, some of the more faster growing parts of the world, there is an opportunity to do a little bit better.
Can I ask you what you do this? If, more specifically, if you took into account the impact of the crisis into this forecast?
Yeah.
2007 or after that?
No, we took into account the crisis, and in fact, I'll show you some numbers that include, I would say, not the Eurozone crisis that we are going through at the moment, but certainly the 2008 financial crisis and the impact that has had on London's financial sector contribution. So that we have looked at as part of this overall picture. I think, you know, I've seen the latest version of the CityScope, the 2012 CityScope report, and I think what it basically shows is a very even more significant shrinking. Not surprisingly, right? But the facts do bear it out, a significant shrinking in terms of growth expectations for many of the southern European cities. Very modest growth in the rest of the Eurozone, with the exception of Germany, which is stronger. And London continues to grow. London continues to grow. Because you'll see the split of contribution by sector. There is definitely more one can do in terms of improving growth prospects for some industries, but I think London still remains fairly well off, even post Eurozone crisis. And this basically shows a little bit what this sort of plots the GDP per capita growth against GDP growth. And I think what's fairly interesting here is, you know, if you look at the median, not surprisingly, as we discussed some of the southern European cities, and this is focused somewhat on European, this is all European cities only plotted on it, not global. And not surprisingly, I think London does come above the median, but then there are some other cities that are also growing. I was personally very surprised to see Oslo growing so significantly. I'm not quite sure what is growing, driving that growth. But certainly, I think London, Paris, Germany remain a little bit above the median, and not surprisingly, some of the southern European countries sort of end up below the median. And I think, you know, going back to the point that we were discussing earlier, relative to its size, the overall growth, which is basically now projected up to 2025, and both in terms of overall GDP growth as well as per capita growth, it's fine, it's modest. It's definitely not top tier, and you can see some of the smaller cities, and including some German cities and some Eastern European cities, making up most of the higher growth potential, not surprisingly. But then, you know, London is sort of, for its relative size, it's not so bad. I think the more interesting discussion is to talk a little bit about where you see the potential threats coming. And I think we identify six areas. First is, and you know, this is not a, you know, it's not a, how do you say, it's not quite a, you know, it's not a McKinsey statement on policy or anything like that. These are just observations based on what we are seeing. And these may not be a complete list, so I very much welcome your inputs and feedback to sort of what other challenges might be. But the first is, I think, you know, some of the policies relating to academic institutions and sort of the whole drive towards addressing non-EU migration, we feel is likely to be more of a restriction than it is going to be a source of help for London's preeminence going forward. I think that's one. The second is, and we'll see the numbers in the next page, it is very stark in terms of the financial sector's contribution to London, and some of the discussions that are currently going on in the Eurozone about a financial transactions tax or whatever, you know, if there is going to be a super equivalent, as we call it, regulation that sort of is European market wide, you know, it'll be interesting to see, given London's dependence on that sector, what kind of impact it is likely to have. I think physical expansion, both as a result of, you know, how you see the green belt, as well as some obvious constraints that we all face in our day-to-day life within London, I think that is a pretty important challenge. And in terms of what are some creative solutions for breaking through, something like that is an issue. The fourth is, we feel that the quality of infrastructure, and we all love to sort of talk and complain, I suppose, about Heathrow and so on and so forth, but poor infrastructure, particularly I think around transportation, but also increasingly, as we will see this happening UK-wide in terms of the energy sector, etc., and the impact that it is going to have, as well as some tax regimes. That's another factor which could dampen the potential for growth in London. I do think that, you know, compared to the past, we are not quite seeing the kind of investment that needs to be going into the arts and to heritage. So just to give you an example, if you sort of look at the funding for arts and museums and so on and so forth, we are seeing that going down both from the government as well as from private corporate sponsors. And there is a, we have some incredibly unique institutions here in the UK, whether it's, you know, Tate Britain or the Royal Academy, National Theatre, and so on and so forth. We are not entirely sure, again, looking at the numbers and looking at the analysis, whether the appropriate investment is going into something like that.
Just on that, there was an incredible burst of investment in London in the years just after the lottery got going, mid-90s to 2003.
Yes.
We got investment in our key cultural institutions that we hadn't seen for 40 years.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that there may be a bit of a lull now, but you need to look at that period of massive investment in only 10, 15 years ago.
Yes. Now, I mean, this is a topic of particular interest for me because, you know, I actually just finished a piece of work with one of the art institutions, a pro bono piece of work, looking at how they can revive their corporate sponsorships. And I think it's quite interesting. People, you know, the funding, corporate funding, has been overly reliant on one or two sectors, particularly banking, financial services, and so on and so forth, because they are the ones who largely sponsor most of the exhibitions. understandably, that sector taking a hit has had a domino effect, a spillover effect on some of these institutions as well. But I think there's a huge opportunity to be less dependent on government aid and on traditional sources of funding, because if you really think about it, this is still the city with the stock exchange where a number of international firms want to come and invest. And I think there's a great opportunity to actually leverage that to try and get new sources of funding into the London art scene. But I think that's something worth discussing a bit further as well. And then, of course, education. I think we do need to talk about this as well, because I think at the end of the day, this is essentially going to be the future engine for growth. But let me just pause here and sort of before we go much further and see whether do people feel these are some of the right issues? Do people feel there are other issues? Do people feel these are not the, you know, this is not really the case? What's the feeling in the room?
Can you just ask a bit more detail on London's internet expansion?
Yes.
What do you mean by, you mentioned the Green Belt.
Well, I think there is the main issue obviously relates to the airport, given the challenges that Heathrow is operating under. And if you actually look at the volumes of traffic that we have lost to the two other main hubs in the region, Frankfurt and Zurich, I think the numbers are actually quite interesting. They obviously do not quite have the scale and size that Heathrow has got, but certainly in terms of market share, they've started taking away more and more market share, more and more connections, more and more passenger traffic, particularly connecting traffic. Those two cities, we are losing that. And again, I'm not an expert on airports, but if you believe that Heathrow is operating at 99% capacity, these kind of large infrastructure projects obviously have a very long lead time in terms of getting built. And obviously there are a number of proposals underway at the moment, including Boris Island and all the other things that we hear about. I do think that we need to find a way to break the deadlock, because whether you kind of take traffic at the moment, and if you, again, we looked at some of the traffic numbers, the relative expansion in traffic increase has significantly outpaced infrastructure increase in London, right? And this is despite putting in place road congestion charges and some of the other mechanisms and so on and so forth. So it's basically around how do you de-bottleneck transportation infrastructure within London and also the surrounding airport. I think that's really the main focus of what we are saying.
Interestingly, I had a comment back from someone very senior at the Corporation of London today on a similar point to number four.
Yeah.
And he says, take out HQs, it's businesses, not HQs, that matter to London. JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Deutsche Bank, Nomura, all have business here, big business, they don't have their HQs here, it doesn't matter. So just a bit of a counter to four.
No, I think it's a good point. Maybe HQ is probably not the right word. I think it's more around where do you want the center of gravity for certain businesses to be located. And you're absolutely right, because when I look at this, sorry about the very complicated nature of the chart, but all it's saying is financial services to the overall contribution to the overall balance of payments, and this is just a progression over 3 years. This is UK. And this is comparing it to a number of other countries. We are disproportionately, so the center of gravity for financial institutions obviously is very much in the UK. I think one of the things we should talk about, and we'll probably get to this when we think about the solution space, is what are some of the other industries that can find a natural home in London that the city could do a better job of promoting? It's obviously not going to be manufacturing, that's very clear, right? But there are actually a number of other services that we can promote in addition to this significant contribution from banking and financial services to the UK. So, you know, I agree with you. You know, headquartering, Rio Tinto here doesn't make much of a difference, because all the guys are working in mines in very strange places around the world. So HQ is probably a misnomer, but I think it's around how do you look at the center of gravity, and you can define that, you know, either through number of people, but not always, because let's say, for example, you're in a business where creative talent is incredibly important. You want to actually have the core of the creative talent, let's say in the media industry,
yeah,
wanting to be located here in London.
Yahoo are a very good example. They have their HQ formerly here.
Who, sorry?
Yahoo,
yeah.
And
yeah,
they moved their formal HQ to Geneva, but they left all their clever.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Switzerland is the exact the other example of what, because they all locate there for a certain reason,
yeah,
but the center of gravity, the key people are not really there. Yeah. What about some of the other topics around sort of education and students and immigration and so on?
I mean, a number of these issues have come up in earlier seminars during the series, which is kind of good. But certainly the question of restrictions on London's physical expansion,
yeah,
came up in a slightly, it has come up in the way you described it in relation to the airport, but also in relation to the question of whether, well, to put it crudely, one should build on the green belt.
Yes.
That came up. And then there are, you know, arguments on both sides of that. On the underinvestment in primary, secondary and tertiary education, and that's emerged previously, but is disguised as skill, really, hasn't it? It's more, I mean, particularly in the question about how, in this city and other cities, the skill basis,
yes,
is sufficient to allow the economy to function without massive international immigration, or,
yeah,
putting it more gently, or in the context of the recent past, how is it that London has managed to generate so many new jobs in the last 10 or 15 years, but leaving patches of extreme unemployment and poverty within a mile or two of where all the jobs have been generated? But I would ask, I mean, is underinvestment really what you think the report means? I mean, is it underinvestment or something else? I mean, given that spending on certainly primary and secondary education in London increased very rapidly in the last decade, is that what? So does this report suggest it's still underinvested, the spending is too low, or that there is some other problem? I think I would ask from the chair.
Yeah.
I mean, underinvestment suggests the need for more money, whereas I think many policymakers wouldn't see it as only a matter of money.
No. No, I think what we talk about in the report is, obviously, I think, you know, the concept we talk about is where the investment is being targeted,
mm-hmm,
and whether it is achieving the right response. Because if you really think about some of the skills that the country needs, right? Let's say, for example, it's around infrastructure development, right? Let's take infrastructure as an area, or energy as an area, for example. If we are going to be building a new generation of nuclear power plants, or if we are going to be building, you know, lots of wind farms and so on and so forth, is the standard of education, is the standard of education and is the focus of education directing, you know, people at a very early age towards the skill sets that the country is going to need for the future? I think that's the question it's really asking. So when we say underinvestment, we mean less about absolute levels of investment, because honestly, when you look back at the numbers have only gone up. They haven't really gone down.
Mm-hmm.
And I could make the same argument for healthcare as well, even though we don't quite talk about it here. The numbers have only gone up. It's essentially about whether the investment is being targeted in the right place, and whether it is achieving, quote unquote, the right return on investment, that I think we should be discussing.
But in some respects as well, there's a bit of a disconnect between policy and practice. So if you look at number one,
yeah,
and you look at number six, in,
yes,
some ways they're actually interrelated.
Yes.
So the idea of investment in tertiary education is very important, but part of that investment comes through actual good, strong international students who are attracted to come here, not just in terms of fees, but actually in terms of the dynamism they bring to classes. And by being attracted, it makes the process better overall.
Yeah.
But if you look at kind of current government policy, there's certainly a mismatch between what BIS wants and,
yeah,
what the Home Office wants,
yeah,
in terms of
Yeah.
That I'm completely in agreement with current reforms, but certainly the immigration reforms that have brought through is actually very damaging to our universities. So
yeah.
I think that that is also, I think there's a lack of understanding of how policies are made up.
Yeah, I mean, so I am not an expert on sort of government policy, but I sort of, from my own experience, I, you know, the other thing that I do besides working in cities is actually, it's a related topic, but I work quite a bit in the energy sector, and we are doing some work right now with the UK government in that area. And I think you talk about inconsistency between, say, ministries, if you will, or departments. I think even within departments, we see inconsistency, so I'm afraid that's a fact of life that that one needs to deal with.
I'd like to say something about the restrictions on London's physical expansion in relation to point four, the reduced attractiveness of critical mass or whatever. I mean, it's a very simplistic way to think of things, but I am concerned about the quality of housing as being an issue. It's not often talked about, and I'm not talking about provision of key worker housing, but I'm actually talking about, it's very trite to say, well, the reason that a company is set up in a place is because it's somewhere that the MD wants to live. There is an element of truth there, and one of the great attractions of London is it's where a lot of MDs or wealthy people, heads of particularly financial institutions, want to live and can afford to live. But I think that's where I think of the physical expansion of London being restricted, not at the Greenbelt, but at the sort of ring of 1930s and later suburbs that kind of strangled London. My concern would actually be sort of the expansion of desirable central London. If you're talking about, and I don't mean that in a snobbish way, I just mean that we know that that's not the sort of place that a lot of people want to live. So if you're talking about attracting the creatives, which are, you know, and talking about tech industry being an important alternative to the financial services sector, you know, we've got places like Dalston just happened, you know, that very much about urban living and the revitalisation. But there's a limit, there's a limit to the physical characteristics that can be rejuvenated. And it seems to me very difficult to see how you might make Morden as exciting as Dalston currently is. I'm just trying to sort of, so there's something about the physical form that actually starts restricting London in terms of the capital we all think of long before you get to the Green Belt.
Indeed.
And it seems to me that a whole different set of policies might be needed to talk about the or address the sort of revitalization or regeneration of suburban London in the way that we've sort of tackled inner city.
But
just to check out, and do you mean that they are literally in need of regeneration, or that there needs to be a sort of creeping urbanisation of them? Inner Londonisation,
not so
of outer London.
Fewer
semis, more big blocks.
I've nothing against the semis per se, but there does seem to be something about a critical mass and a density. No, I call it not density, an intensity of life that's a London story. And state agents love to talk about villages, you know, and the whole London sort of series of urban villages, but it does seem that that's a pretty attractive sort of theme. The trouble is that suburban development has pretty much killed that sort of vibe, if you like. And I think there's huge scope for the. And it doesn't. I think Wandsworth proves it doesn't take much to sort of energise a suburb.
Yes.
But it takes some kind of a centre and an intensity of use that is singularly missing in many of these. Sort of homogenous suburbs, and therefore, you know, the policy has to be much more focused, actually, directed, not sort of necessarily blanketing initially the whole of suburbia, but I think probably some kind of growth areas need to be identified, or successful suburbs need to be identified, and allowed to develop as urban centres, or nodes, or foci, or whatever, perhaps around transport. There probably needs to be some letting go of industrial uses and local employment generating uses for more intensive use, but that would be
wouldn't an issue there be that part of the vibrancy of the London residentials is that they're right next to your place of work? So by making them remote in the suburbs, unless you are creating them as employment centres as well as residential centres, then you're not going to get that vibrancy because everyone will be back in London all day and all evening.
Yeah, I think a lot of people spend quite a lot of time travelling in to the city from South West London. I think sort of the Richmonds and Twickenham and even Wandsworth, you know, they're not places of work. I mean, they're not cheap by jowl places of work, but there's a vibrancy there that you don't tend to see further out.
Yeah, so what creates, not transport that's created it, is it?
I would argue it's intensity of use. I think there's
somewhere like Richmond, it's open space and river and amenity.
And there's a lot of amenity there.
Okay, now we just need to I'll take that point. I just need to say we need to.
Sorry.
Pace. No. This is fine. We just need to pace ourselves to be through that time. Other three people try to get in at six. So we'll take one more question and if we can. Have you got
okay.
Many,
we don't have a lot left.
Oh,
I mean, I have maybe
okay.
A couple of more ideas.
Very good.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was actually going to argue the point that transport is a key to some of the redevelopment. And when you look at the impact of the extension of the London Overground and the East London Line on the revitalization of places like Crystal Palace and how they link to Dalston and how that's now creating a sense of energy in those suburbs along that line, what that connection has done has really revitalized some of these suburbs and led to increased places of use for all of these tech workers coming in. But then the question comes down to restrictions on London's physical expansion and also restrictions on the way London operates. The fact that you do have a transport system that shuts at midnight, how is that limiting then the ability of us to grow outside of these networks?
Yeah. It's a very good point. I mean, coming back to something that you said, you know, I was thinking a little bit about I don't know if this is the right parallel, but if you take New York, right, because you've got Manhattan and then you've got Brooklyn and Queens and some of the other boroughs, and I think I was very struck by something you said earlier, which is how do you make sure that you, and maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but you know, how do you retain the character of what is the core of the city and then how do you extend it out? Mm-hmm. And I think there are but at the same time, you know, there are going to be some real limits to doing that. But at the same time, can you actually develop other, and this is definitely the wrong word, satellites, if you will, around the core that have their own personality and vibrancy and their own characteristic? I think it's worth thinking about.
I think we've done that. I mean, what's Guildford and Reading? That's two land bases.
Yeah.
Those are the successful near-London developers.
That's true. And I was thinking as well about the East London development now, the Olympics and so on and so forth, and what that could do. That could, again, be quite interesting.
And I think, Yolanda, there's a difference between Ilford and Croydon. I think the Guildford, St. Albans, in Oxford and Cambridge version of London undoubtedly has that in the middle, those growing strongly outside but I think you were talking about the things that are still inside the continuously built up area.
Yeah, I think the point I was trying to make is a bit more something than just sort of very obvious regeneration stories, or even the out of town ones. But I mean, I'm interested in the fact that actually the story of the growth of urban London, places we now think is absolutely central, it's actually a story of subsumed suburbs and villages, which actually means that the intensification of use of the growing area of intense sort of central London can grow. But I think I'm concerned, I suppose, that in the past it's been able to grow one way or another. But the sort of regeneration that I see now is very much about the regeneration of inner cities. The whole model is built around that. And we can't, using that model, seem to tackle suburbia largely because the land is physically occupied by quite low density by individual owner-occupiers, for example. So that's one of the physical elements of this sort of ring of of suburbia that constrains London, that it's very difficult to tackle.
Yeah.
And it would need completely different models to intensify.
Mm-hmm.
And they're models that would have happened very naturally in the past, because there was a lack of a planning framework, or a certain type of planning framework. So residential properties would, for example, over a period of time, have retail put on the ground floor or whatever, and they
yes.
were able to adapt. I think, therefore, we actually need the sort of policies that are going to allow for a totally different type of neighbourhood development, let's say. How does a group of individual owner-occupiers on a cul-de-sac or a piece of 1930s suburbia actually set about intensifying and using the land collectively, for example? It's a whole different kettle of fish to anything we've ever faced.
Would these people recognise that there's a problem to solve?
Looking at London, you recognise there's a problem to solve because there's a simple need. There's lots of people coming into it and nowhere for them to go. But I'm just putting forward.
There's still quite a lot of brownfield sites that contain that. It can absorb that expansion.
Okay, this is Michael, and then we'll move on. Then take one.
Can I just add one point to this exchange about greater intensity in the suburbs? I would have thought that we are confronting in London a really serious problem, which essentially is that through some rather crazy things that have happened in the various land and property markets over the years, which you're very expert on now, where you've studied. We've got residential land values in suburban London which are massive compared with land values for us anything else. So anything that happens in suburban London, if you can manage to stop it and extinguish it and switch the land into residential use, either as well or medium or preferably high density, you make a fortune. So every car repair garage, office block, dentist surgery, school, college, whatever,
yeah.
disappears and is replaced by housing. And housing doesn't produce vibrant stuff that you want. But what you really want is more Hampsteads to sell, more St. John's Woods, more Richmond's. And I don't think that the property market is going to produce that because we've let housing values get totally out of hand compared with the value of land or anything else. So I kind of rather despair.
While we have
these land value relationships.
Well, you could use that land value to, you could actually find ways of enhancing that to actually drive the regeneration or reimagining of suburban London, if you like.
Mainly they're occupying a housing for sale, because that's where.
Yeah, but I mean, there would be. I don't know that. I mean, right now it's difficult to read what the political reaction would be, but an individual owner-occupier who owns actually a very inefficient site, effectively, it's semi-detached on a large garden, theoretically, is sitting on a lot of land value. If you'd rather not have the working, the jobbing builder's yard or the garage repair land taken for development, then actually the only alternative is to find ways of releasing people's back gardens. And I don't mean in back garden ground and the sort of thing that's been done by the house builder. But I mean actually individual groups of individuals collectively intensify their own plots. And that's a way of using land value to actually enable the development to take place, probably provide some income and pensions for individual landowners and provide more housing. And what would then be a neighbourhood that could support a local shop or whatever it is? This is what I mean by taking a completely different land model that needn't necessarily involve house builders and conventional land sales and reliance on that industrial work.
I'd be a bit more optimistic, Michael. And there are some examples in outer London of centres which have declined in their own original terms, but where housing is now in part replacing the lost industrial, the lost economic activity, housing can be economic activity, thus liberating. Ilford and Croydon, surely. Both Ilford and Croydon have got heavy residential developments, often in towers, big buildings, in what were relatively low-rise centres, whose shopping offer has been badly damaged by change. I mean, whether it'll work is not, well, it's slightly more optimistic take on the point you were making than what you do about downtown Wheelstone is another matter.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we must move on.
Good. I mean, there's not a lot. There's not a lot more. But you know, I mean, we were. And again, I apologize for this slightly busy slide. But there are a few areas that we've looked at where I do think that London is facing, you know, a few challenges, and the report talks about it in quite a bit of detail. Let me just pick a couple of areas. I think if you take, for example, you know, the whether we think about tax regimes and tax rates, and there's a lot of discussion going on right now with the budget, which way that is going to go and how that is going to drive development and future development of London, both corporate as well as personal tax rates, I think is going to be a pretty important factor. There is, we talked a little bit already about transport and so on and so forth. I think, you know, that is going to be a real issue. So there are a number of areas. There is definitely a watch list. What's very striking for me is when we looked at this analysis and we said, where is the competitiveness increasing versus flat versus decreasing? There actually aren't any areas that we observe where competitiveness is actually going up. Right? I mean, if you can sort of think of areas where you feel we have actually improved and increased our competitiveness, again, vis-a-vis the Frankfurts and the New Yorks and so on and so forth, and indeed the emerging destinations in the Middle East or in China and so on, and they all have their own limitations. But I think it's worth thinking a little bit about what this certainly forced me to do was think a little bit about where have we increased our competitiveness as London in the last 2 or 3 years. And I think it's worth hearing a few of your reflections on that.
Well, let me offer you, I've spoken too much, Richard. One, in recent years, the extraordinary internationalization of London's population to turn it to being one of the most, probably one of the places with largest number of population groups of over 10,000 born in an array of countries of any in the world.
Mm-hmm,
one,
mm-hmm,
I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
The other more difficult sort of tolerant hedonism, a kind of difficult to measure thing that doesn't fit in any of these, which is a sort of tolerance of difference, where New York, London, Paris will, I would have thought, do relatively better. They may not be gaining in those terms, but.
Mm-hmm.
About those two.
Yeah. Any others?
Do you disagree with any of this?
Is there anything about, and this is maybe a bit superficial, but certainly seems to be having an impact at the moment as a post-financial crisis issue, a kind of flight to safety, which is certainly seems to be seeing the London property market be sustained, whereas the rest of the UK is declining.
Yeah.
And that and that gives us some benefits. Obviously, there are downsides too. But you know, one
of
them is never entirely.
Yeah. Well, I suppose in the UK context, yes. But I was also thinking more along the lines of in competition with other major talent centers, if you want to call them that. You know.
Mike, go
ahead. Can I ask you to change your perspective for a moment?
Okay.
I mean, you're talking a bit about this competition between cities, a bit as though it was the Olympic Games, you know, where the aim is to get the gold medal. But suppose we didn't think about it like that, and we thought you were commissioned by, you know, the mayor of London or something. So, where in this global ranking should we aim? Maybe we should say we're full, or we had enough of it, or we're 12th. Would be tremendous benefits from having a bit less of this sometimes big investment.
Yeah.
A bit less of some of these pressures.
Yeah.
Better with some of our problems. Do you have a comment on that?
You know, I mean, I think the. I mean, I, you know, these sort of league table type discussions, I think, are helpful to a point. They are helpful to a point because, you know, first of all, different people will say they are leading on different dimensions, and anybody can come up with any sort of league table. We've come up with one, and you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that that is the be all and end all. I think what we are essentially arguing for, and to me, I think the previous discussion we were having here, for us, the concern that we see is, I think London has punched well above its weight over the past few years, both in terms of its contribution to the UK economy and indeed in comparison to some of the other cities. But we do see some real concerns in terms of sustaining, that growth. And we would say, if we were advising the mayor, we would say a more sustainable and balanced model of growth that addresses the fact that you're highly over-reliant on one particular industry, which is going through a very challenging period at the moment. That's something to think about.
Can I ask you why you didn't put that in your potential spec?
In the, sorry?
Why isn't it amongst the six?
Over-reliance on financial sector.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, well, we wanted to talk about that. I mean, it sort of comes through, you know, fairly clear over here. I'll, you know, we had another, here we go. So I think we, and maybe this goes a little bit to answering your question. If we were to advise the mayor of London, we would say, look, you need to think about it along all of these five dimensions. One is sort of, what are going to be some of the economic clusters around which growth is really going to happen, number one. Number two, how do we make sure that we are actually attracting and retaining the best talent from around the world? Number three, you know, small businesses. If small businesses have to be set up, and if they want to prosper and grow, how are you going to create the conditions for that to happen? The fourth is the infrastructure. We talked about transportation as an example, but it is going to be a pretty important factor that sort of links movement and people and goods and so on and so forth. How do you de-bottleneck that? And the fifth is, you know, the public and civic institutions that you have, do they put in place the right enablers to incentivize, you know, attracting those sectors and that human capital? Now, to me, at the end of all this, if you were to have a policy for London that addresses these five dimensions, and if we make progress along these five dimensions, whether we end up as number one or four or five, I'm really less concerned about. But I don't see at the moment, or we don't see, a joined up policy or strategy that addresses all of these five dimensions for the city. And that's our real concern and our real message. I don't know if that answers your question. So the league tables are helpful, but they are not an end in themselves.
And you just like another different kind of league table, really, wouldn't you, Michael? That's what you're asking, which is fair enough. Different league tables for different things. Martin.
Yes, Martin Simmons. I think that some of the points you're making here are in fact addressed if you take a wider view of the London region.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're talking about innovation and entrepreneurship and economic sectors and clusters. And Tony, I think you put your finger on this earlier when you were referring to places like Reading and Cambridge and so on. That if you take a wider view of what London's functional region is,
yes,
there's a lot happening.
Yes.
In fact, outside the administrative area of Greater London. If you take the Thames Valley area, for example,
mm-hmm,
and you look at the clusters that have grown there, stimulated by quite a lot of inward investment.
Yes.
What the Polynet study a few years ago examined in that area about how, with information technology, there
mm-hmm.
was a burgeoning, in fact, of dynamic startup businesses related to the
yes.
bigger businesses that had moved in under inward investments and so on. Now the problem is largely an administrative one of how in fact a mayoral regime in London can relate to this wider functional London in a situation where regional bodies have been abolished under the Localism Act. So the mayor has no ability, in fact, to talk to this wider functional hinterland.
Indeed, yes.
And that's a problem. So there's the point I'm making is that it is happening out there in the wider functional region, but we don't have the ability, in fact, to analyse effectively across that wider functional region what is happening and what kind of policy framework needs to be put in place.
Do by all means comment, but it's an elegantly made point.
Well, I mean, you know, I think, well, the first thing that I would say is we are not discounting things that are happening. You know, the development of the tech city, for example, is another very interesting example. The use of the Olympics to rejuvenate part of the country is sort of another example. We are not discounting things that are happening. I think what we are essentially saying is London has a pretty unique place globally. And I hate to keep coming back to this point about competition, but when we sort of look at what some of the other cities around the world are doing, because at the end of the day, in this environment, capital is scarce. The kind of talent you want is particularly scarce. And I think it is quite interesting to see how some of the other cities around the world are either creating economic incentives or are very proactively either using their governments or their heads of state, or in some cases their mayors, to go out and attract that sort of investment. So we feel, I mean, you know, there are some more specific recommendations and suggestions that we have. I don't want to go into each of those, but you know, let me just take one. You know, if I take, for example, innovation and entrepreneurship, are we doing everything that we can in bioscience, in high tech, professional and business services, and so on and so forth? Yes, financial services, of course, we are already fairly strong. You know, are we doing everything there? Or, you know, to your earlier point, when you think about decision rights for London, you know, should we be arguing for stronger decision rights for London as part of decentralization of power to the cities? Or we talked a little bit about the Green Belt. Should we allow